All right, what's up? Heron just came in.
Hey,
what's up, Heron?
What's up?
Thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
So I met Heron, and we met in Istanbul like a few weeks ago,
yeah,
a month ago or something like that, mm-hmm. for the opening of a new shop that we worked on. So it was a real nice last-minute add to this, so I appreciate you coming out.
For sure.
But just a really quick intro. I think a lot of people probably already know what you do and who you are, but obviously a big part is running Heron Preston,
right.
the label.
Mm-hmm.
But I know in Istanbul you were also there for a DJ
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, came out to DJ. Yeah, designer, DJ.
You always get that question where you're like, what do you do? And it's like 20 different things.
Yeah, for sure. I usually just go down down the list. But yeah, the main stuff that keeps me the busiest is you know, DJs, DJ sets, and my collections, my yeah. brand.
And the collection's been getting bigger and bigger over the last few years, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, this next collection that I'll be presenting in January, you'll see a whole bunch of women's that's grown. In the past, it's been a very, very tiny assortment of women's. So the women's is really growing crazy. I'm introducing a whole bunch of footwear as well.
Had you done footwear before?
I've done boots already, but just boots. So now I'm introducing some sneakers, and I'm introducing like, you know, women's footwear as well. Huh. I got some heels, and I got some really high boots, and yeah, no, it's exciting to just, you know, every season it, you know, grows. And
I mean,
just
the speed of that industry is crazy.
Yeah, I know. It is. It's almost a little too fast for my liking.
Yeah.
But you know, this is what I signed up for. This is what I signed up for. You know, I definitely give it to those who don't necessarily need to follow a fashion calendar. You know, a traditional calendar, the one that I follow. So, yeah, man, the speed is insane. It's insane. You know, you always just have to kind of, you know, I'm learning to train myself to always have fresh ideas yeah. and always kind of be a season ahead and, you know, just constantly just, you know, feeding myself, you know, inspiration and ideas. And, you know, my eyes have been trained to see the world a little differently now huh. because, you know, I always kind of use the example of like, you know, depending on what you do, you see the world that way. So, you know, growing up as a skater in San Francisco, I wouldn't just see a handrail
yeah,
as
yeah.
something to help me get up and down some steps. That was a skate obstacle for me. So now, you know, I'm a designer and like store signs and colors.
Like everything's just
everything
like...
is something that can be incorporated into, yeah. You know, what I'm doing.
So just for the people that are not in the fashion industry, the schedule is it like four times a year you have to have a new collection?
Well, yeah, if you're doing like pre-collections and all that stuff. But for me, I'm just doing twice a year.
Okay.
Yeah. I show during Men's Week in Paris in January and in June. But just recently, my partners were like, hey, we're going to start doing pre-collections now.
Like,
so I'm like, oh, shit.
But that means like in 6 months, it's not only obviously like having an idea, designing it, refining it, making draft pieces, but actually having something that's like show ready. And is it also like figuring out the manufacturing for when
yeah,
when
you
people
know,
buy it?
It's a race against time. It's truly a race against time with deadlines and factories and scheduling and having those prototypes done on time. You know, like there's been moments where I'm like shooting the lookbook and pieces are actually still arriving to the shoot. So, you know, it's literally down to seconds. Down to the minutes and seconds. And so, yeah, dude, it's hectic, man. It's really hectic. Yeah.
And most of the stuff is made out in Milan?
On the outskirts of Milan.
Okay.
Like, you know, every factory I've gone to in Italy, it's like a 2-hour, 3-hour drive or
right.
train from my office in Milan. And that's a lot of like the outerwear and the denim and accessories. And then t-shirts and hoodies, right? So all of the cotton. The fleece and the jersey, that's all in Portugal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And I think we talked about this a little bit in Istanbul, but obviously that means you're traveling all the time.
Yeah.
And...
Yeah, if it's not for fashion, it's for DJing. And so, like, my calendar, my year calendar
October was brutal for me.
That was brutal. That was super brutal. I was like in Istanbul. I was in Italy twice. Then I went to Russia. I went to Moscow a week later after Istanbul. I was in LA. You know, I was just going everywhere. I think I had to go to London. So yeah, October was, and so much so I was like, is this a normal amount of work? Or am I doing too much? Or like what? Like, and you know, it's hard because you know my girlfriend and I got a new puppy, and so like they want me to be home, you know, and so I'm only home for like maybe two nights, and then I'm back on the road again. So no, but you know, this all comes with the territory, and everyone's got an appetite for more these days. You know, they want you to be a part of this, they want to be part of this, and all these moments that we have around the world, right? Uh-huh. The store launch in Istanbul, everyone's in Istanbul all of a sudden, then you know, all the fashion weeks, and then you've got like all these cultural moments that are happening on the calendar, from music moments like, you know, Coachella, to like art moments like Basel, to then you have fashion weeks, and then you have like, you know, the Grammys and Oscars and all these weekends, mm-hmm. and All-Star, you know, NBA. So like all of these industries are just have all these moments that somehow I'm kind of involved in. Right. So like it's always on every fucking year.
Do you feel like you're doing like a million things all at once, or because it's all you, obviously?
Yeah.
Does it feel like one project that's you in like all these different facets, or are you literally just like bouncing around from like, do you feel super scattered and all over the place?
Yeah, I do. I do feel super scattered and all over the place, and I hate that. I'm someone who has always literally done everything like by myself. Like just this year, I finally hired, like, I call her my brand manager, to just be the kind of the glue between all of these moving parts that are happening. From scheduling to travel to meetings to phone calls to projects to people who want me to be on stuff to, you know, fielding all those requests. And then, you know, so that's all of that stuff on the that's happening. And then it's like, how do I free my brain to be creative when I have to make all these decisions all day long with like everything I just mentioned? So it's like now I'm kind of at a place in my point in my life where I'm like, all right, how do I kind of divide and conquer, build teams around me to help just streamline and free up, you know, brain space that I can actually focus on designing a collection or designing a capsule or, you know, there's all these amazing opportunities. You know, I'm working with Nike. I have a collaboration coming out this month with them, and then there's more stuff coming out. And, you know, all these amazing legendary companies, you know, want to work with me, and I want to be able to deliver something high level, something premium. You know, I don't want to half-ass deliver some weak-ass shit to them. And, you know, so all these opportunities are also a lot of pressure as well to deliver great ideas. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the only way for me to actually get to these great ideas is having some space, time to breathe and sit down and think through stuff and talk to my friends and just bounce ideas off of, you know, whoever I trust around my, in my life. And then, you know, so yeah, at this point, it's just like, how do you...
Now it's just running at the moment.
Yeah. Huh? How do you kind of, you know, master this pace that's happening?
I mean, especially now, like, with the label, like, really, like, it seems like every year it's, like, bigger and bigger and bigger. And I'm like you said, it's like you're getting all these asks and demands and getting yourself involved in more stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, you want to be able to do that stuff. Yeah. Because that stuff is... A lot of stuff is cool. But it's like, fuck, I don't have time to fucking eat. You know what I mean? Like, how am I gonna fucking do this project? So a lot of times I just realized this past October, again, thinking about how brutal that month was, I like spoke to my brand manager, Cara, and I was like, yo, I need to block off Mondays, no more meetings, no more phone calls, nothing on Mondays. Because I just need those days. I need that day to just have
just
for
like
myself.
Just like 1/7 of your time.
Yeah. We can start meetings and phone calls and stuff on like Tuesdays, but like Mondays, like block that off for me. So I'm starting to learn what works for me, what doesn't, just based off of the demand of what's happening.
What I like is like you're in the middle of this like spurt, which is amazing. This like acceleration, which is really exciting.
Yeah.
And I was curious, like, because obviously, A, is just trying to keep up with all the pace that's going on that you've created, but also going on around you.
Yeah.
And it was like, are you, do you feel at the moment that you're able to strategize, okay, this is what I want to do in 5 years and I'm going towards that? Or you're just like, there's an opportunity here, I'm going to pursue that. There's an opportunity here, I'm going to pursue that. Mm. And sort of reacting to things around you.
It's a little bit of both. I think right now I've been kind of just reacting, been very reactive to like opportunities and stuff. But, you know, I've made a point for like next year to kind of map out what this kind of 2019 is going to look like what this journey is going to look like, right? So I really care a lot about sustainability and upcycling. So I'm really focused on only kind of involving myself in projects that involve sustainability and like upcycling. Yeah. So I'm mapping out kind of like all of these collaborations and all these projects. And so it's easier, you know, because I never really set some crazy goals or roadmaps to point somewhere. Because I think I'm still kind of, you know, sinking my teeth into like fashion. Mm. You know, I didn't study fashion design, and I had always kind of, you know, seen myself as an artist more than a fashion designer. I was always doing smaller drops, t-shirt drops or objects or something like that. And so, you know, just I think now that I'm like 2 years into this, I'm starting to finally learn and pick up like what I want to do and what I don't want to do.
It's only been 2 years.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah. It's only been like two years amazing. Since I launched the collection. Yeah. So everything has happened so fast. But I'm kind of all of this feedback that I've gained over the past 2 years, I'm finally realizing, all right, what I want to focus on and where I want to put my energy.
Did you launch it with the Department of Sanitation collaboration?
That's kind of like the beginning of when I made a ton of noise around, you know, my creativity in the city. So the partners that I have now who work with me on my collections in Italy, they came to that presentation.
That's cool. You weren't signed on to them before that.
No, I wasn't. Right. They came, they experienced all of that. They were immersed and engaged in that whole experience. And so, you know, when they were able to witness that, they loved it, you know. Shortly after that, we had conversations of turning Heron Preston into like a full collection,
right.
Merched out, you know, full, you know, outerwear, denim, footwear, accessories, retail, you know, showroom in Paris, sales campaign and presentations and fashion. So like that's, you know, so the DSNY, I think that really helped.
Do you remember at that point, were you... like even going into the idea of doing something with Department of Sanitation, for example, like were you like, okay, this will actually make a lot of noise. This is actually potentially a way to then launch into a full label, or were you just like, this seems rad. Let's try it and see what happens.
Yeah, it was more like, this seems rad. Let's try it and see what happens. This is definitely going to make a lot of noise. I just knew it deep down inside. I just knew that this had never been done before. Ever. You know, I did my research. I don't think there's ever been a fashion designer to collaborate with a sanitation department. So I knew, you know, automatically just because of that, people would take notice. It was just felt very sticky, like a sticky idea to me. And it was also something I was very passionate about as well. I wanted to incorporate, you know, my design, innovation, my art, my creativity, and into what my friend likes to call a wicked issue. And so that was the environment. I wanted to figure out a way that I can, you know, work on things I care about while also, you know, working on like fashion, working on creativity. So yeah, there was that. You know, I wanted to just get involved with, you know, sustainability and helping, you know, clean up the environment. But I also thought it was just super rad. And I was like, let's see, you know, how far we can push.
Well, it's also like on a visceral level, I love that like, Department of Sanitation uniforms are just actually almost in like any city around the world. They're like really specific and like kind of loud and actually really unique, but you never think of it as fashion per se.
No, you never think of it as fashion. But I mean, you know, fashion is just like enhanced reality. And with Heron Preston, I'm more about the reality. And so I look at them as, you know, they wear, you know, Timberlands, they wear like Dickies, and they wear, you know, dress shirts and you know, work shirts and t-shirts and hoodies. And so that's a language that we're speaking right there, just from, you know, the uniforms, and then just New York City and, you know, I looked at other agencies like the FDNY and the police department and how you see their merch all around New York City. And you never see DSNY merch, you know, sold in airports. You never see it on the streets with tourists. So I thought there was a real opportunity there to kind of, you know, also celebrate, you know, sanitation workers and the Department of Sanitation.
Do you remember what the first conversation was with someone from the department?
Yeah. So when I got the idea to do a collaboration with them, it was originally supposed to be just a T-shirt collaboration. I had this vision of, you know, there's like, 9,000 sanitation workers. I had this vision of seeing 9,000 workers across New York City wearing these Heron Preston collab tees, printed on vintage and secondhand T-shirts. Yeah. So that was kind of the angle there for like sustainability. And so I was like, all right, are they even going to understand this idea? Yeah. Have
like, they ever, what's this?
Why what is like, this? What?
Why wearing this old T-shirt?
Yeah. Are they going to get it? So I did some research and I discovered that on through Twitter, they have an in-house anthropologist named Robin Nagel, who was a New Yorker fascinated with wanting to study and learn more about the DSNY and their workers and what they go through, because she was writing a book. Mm. So she actually went through the steps and the process to become a sanitation worker herself, just in order to be able to study them and follow them on their routes and stuff and go to their roll calls at 6 a.m. to all these stations and really start to, you know, dig deep into, you know, how they operate. So I came across her Twitter, and she had published a tweet that said, you know, DSNY equals most important uniform force in New York City. Come find out why. So I was like, oh, this is perfect opportunity for me to go and see what they're all about and gauge if they would even be interested in an art project.
Where was that meeting or presentation?
I was at the New York City Museum.
Oh, okay.
Uptown. It's near Central Park. So I went to that talk, and within that talk, it was like an hour long, she presented the work of Miro Ukulele, who is their artist in residence. They have an artist in residency at the DSNY, and she's held that same position since like the 70s. Same artist has it held that.
What does she work on there?
She does a lot of performance projects.
Okay.
Art performance projects. So, you know, one of her works was called Touch Sanitation, where she shook the hands of every sanitation worker in New York City in the early 80s. And as she shook their hands, it took her 1 year to do that, by the way. And as she shook every single sanitation worker's hand, she said, "Thank you for keeping New York City alive." And it was this whole milestone in the art performance world, made a lot of noise. And, you know, her whole kind of, the story there was, you know, shining a positive light on sanitation workers. Because without them, like, maintaining New York City, there's like 1,200 trucks that kind of go in and out all day, every day. And imagine if they were to just stop collecting our trash. You know, New York City would literally deteriorate, and we would all catch yellow fever and get sick, and we would all die. But New Yorkers weren't treating them, you know, in a nice way. So she was wanting to, you know, shine a positive light on them. She also did a project called The Social Mirror, which debuted at the 1983 Art Fair Parade here in New York. And she basically kind of like built or put mirrors on the outside of collection trucks. So whatever so you could see a reflection in this truck. And the whole message there was like, we're all in this together.
Okay. But so she was, you said she was the resident artist of DSNY?
Yeah.
So like they already had some conception of the creative side.
Exactly.
That's crazy.
And I had no idea. So when I saw her, when I saw Robin present the work of Miro, I was like, holy shit, they've got an artist?
Yeah.
They've already done art projects? Fuck yeah. So it'll be way easier for me, I think, to present my project because I think they'll totally get it. So I emailed Robin. I found her email, and I pitched this whole big idea of doing this collaboration, and I wanted to speak to Meryl about it because I was like, if anyone is at the DSNY who will get it, it'll be Meryl. Like, she'll totally get this where I'm coming from. Robin politely declined to introduce me to Meryl. I was like, fuck.
You're like, we got this. You're like, fuck.
So, you know, so close but so far away now. And I had like butterflies because of this idea. I was like, I gotta figure this out. It's gonna fucking be crazy if I can pull this off. New Yorkers are gonna go crazy for this. So after she told me no, I was like, goddamn. Didn't give up the idea, but I kind of put it on hold. and literally on hold for like a year.
Oh wow!
I didn't know who else I could reach out to.
You just kind of got stuck.
Yeah, got stuck. So then fast forward to a year later, I went to NADA Art Fair, Basketball City, and was just walking around and I stumbled on a talk. And what drove me to stumble on that talk was I saw a projection of Meryl.
Oh shit!
And her touch sanitation project, dude. It was like, what? This is the woman I've been trying to meet for a year, and she's like in my face. Like the projection of her is in my face. What is this? What's going on? So I went to the talk.
And you hadn't met her yet at this point.
Hadn't met her yet. And so she's in my face on this projection. I'm like, what is this talk? I have to go. And this woman, Dia Vige, who works at the New York City Cultural Affairs Office, was presenting Meryl's work because her work now falls under PAIR, which stands for Public Artists in Residency for New York City. So it was the PAIR team presenting her work. And so after the presentation was done, I went up to Dia from PAIR and I was like, yo, I got this idea. I need to like pitch it to someone at DSNY. Let me pitch it to you first. So we met at Soho House like the next day.
Okay.
I presented this whole idea to her. And there was a whole entire like charitable component as well that was kind of in the light of Meryl thanking sanitation workers for the work that they do. Huh. My version of a thank you was going to be to do a t-shirt collaboration, raise money, and then use that money for whatever they needed it for. You know, I knew that, you know, since they were a city government agency, I knew they experienced budget cuts. So I was like, yo, if you guys had extra money, could always use that money. So then she introduced me to people at the DSNY, like on an email.
Oh, wow. Was Robin part of that at that point?
No, she wasn't. But funny enough, the woman that I actually ended up presenting the project to, her name was Robin as well, which was hilarious. So I presented to another Robin. Oopsies. And so
tea.
Tea everywhere. And then Robin called me back the next day, and she was like, "Let's do it."
That's amazing.
And so that's kind of how it all
that's
happened.
That's rad.
Yeah.
We have a caller question actually, but I just want to finish this like DSNY chunk.
Is this live or?
Yeah, it's
oh,
live.
It is. Oh,
yeah. So okay. We told people to like call in if they want.
Oh, tight.
It's all being recorded and archived.
Okay.
But we'll probably put that out after, so you can see like the stream time. We'll put that out after this whole project's done, which is next week.
Okay.
End of next week.
Sick.
Yeah. So it's live.
Dope.
Where was I? Oh, did you at that point when you were maybe like the first year when you kind of tried to get a hold of them and they're like, nah. Was it? Did you have like a team? Were you already a kind of company? Were you just like
I was by myself. Huh. I was literally by myself. And when I got the approval to do the project with them, it was literally like working out of my little ass apartment on Rivington Street. Like that became like storage slash like studio, design studio. Like it was crazy in my apartment. At that time, I was like by myself, and I finally hired my first intern to help me out. You know, I was making daily trips up to like the garment district to just get stuff made, and going out to Brooklyn to get stuff made, and constantly going to DSNY at 125 Worth, you know, to the government buildings, having meetings all the time. It was like me, my intern, and like that was literally it. <Sorry. laughs>
Were you full time on Heron Press and stuff? Were you still pulling?
No, I wasn't. Heron Press hadn't really taken shape into a full collection yet. That was the only thing that I did. Huh.
Were you still working somewhere else? Anything?
No, I was just on my own. I was DJing, and it was just me. You know, like yeah, that was my only project.
So from like a paying rent point of view,
yeah.
Did DJing actually like allow you to work on this project?
Yeah,
incredible.
I think DJing was paying for the rent. Where else? I know I was probably doing some consulting gigs or some other gigs here and there, but I think DJing was helping pay the rent. And yeah.
Just like cobbling stuff together to get this off the ground.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. Just, you know, it's like almost like a pit bull, like you can't let go until you get it, you know? Like I couldn't let go. I could not let go of the project because I believed in it so much. And I knew it was going to, you know, it was not only going to open doors, but it was going to be very special for the city and for the DSNY, for the department, for everyone involved. You know, Anna Wintour, you know, she put sanitation workers in Vogue for the very first time ever.
That's so amazing.
You know, it was a spread. She gave us a whole entire spread, and she loved it. And, you know, that you know, I got to develop a relationship with Anna Wintour based off, you know, off of this project.
Which is like, you're like, fuck.
Yeah, seriously, like, in, like, yeah, like sitting down at dinner with her and, you know, she's been a super big supporter of this as well. So, no, I'm super happy that I was able to pull it off.
Dude, congrats. What I like also is like that moment where that year in between where you tried to kind of get a hold and that because I always feel like, you know, there's a lot of the guests are kind of like just have your eyes open for opportunities and stuff, mm-hmm. but also feel what's so important is that when you were at NADA and seeing that, I forgot the name of the artist.
Mural.
Yeah. Was presenting that clicked in your mind and that wouldn't have clicked, I think, obviously, if you hadn't kept that project in your mind the whole time.
Exactly.
Like you wouldn't see that thing without kind of having that idea in the
exactly.
beginning.
Exactly, yeah.
And I think that's really key to sort of like, no, it's mm-hmm. great. All right, so Mustafa called in from D.C.
Oh, okay.
We've actually never had a caller call in for a guest, so it's kind of exciting.
Chocolate City.
he wants to know where the military camo influence came from. I guess in general for the current fashion. Like, I mean, obviously you're seeing a lot, but
yeah.
Do you remember like when you started seeing that, when it was kind of like first and fresh?
I mean, for me, I would say I started noticing camo in fashion growing up as a skater. Mm. Skaters just wear camo. You know, we wear military. I grew up in San Francisco. So skating in some like camo pants was like, that was the vibe. Mm. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, Ralph Lauren, you know, he looked at military a lot, in the work that he does. So I think, military and camo has always been a huge influence in fashion. It's funny. I think a lot has, you know, fashion was informed a lot by like war as well. You know, like clothes used to be really stiff, but then when guys went to fight, they came back.
Literal like flexibility needed. Like,
yeah, they came back because they're wearing the same clothes every day, and they came back and they were softer.
No way. That's amazing.
Yeah, they were softer and more comfortable to wear, and so people started making their clothes like that. So you know, wars have influenced a lot, like not only fashion. Get off topic, but like even in like cuisine and food.
It's weird
and
that
stuff.
It's influenced like comfort. You never would think.
Yeah, people, seriously.
Like lounging.
I forget who told me that story, but it made so much sense. Like yeah, when they came back from the war, like the fatigues and the military, everything was just like
broken in.
And so yeah, even like with, you know, not to even go off topic, but even with like denim, you know what I mean? Like denim used to be super stiff, but then like the gold rush, like wearing and tearing, and like that's where distress and like eventually like stretch denim comes from. Again, it's coming from like wearing it a ton. So yeah, military and fashion have always been like, there's always been an intersection between the two.
I mean, both of those, like with the denim and the camo example, but also with the DSMY stuff you were doing, like there's utility that either is identified by someone that wants to take it somewhere else, like fashion designer, or like, you know, you can see that kind of trajectory of like seeing camo being used for utilitarian or for military reason, and then pulling that out into kind of daily wear fashion. Mm-hmm. And what I liked with what you did with the DSMY thing is actually you actually took design into the department, as opposed to just being like, oh, I'm going to make something that looks like a DSNY jacket and sell it as a piece of fashion necessarily. But you actually worked with the department and actually, Jesus Christ, I'm not sure this is tea, like change what they were wearing or kind of influence that.
Yeah.
But I do feel like a lot of really important clothing trends, I guess is maybe not the right word, but come from a utility point of view. Mm-hmm. They were never designed as a kind of piece of design in the first place.
Yeah, uniforms.
Yep.
Uniforms, straight up.
So, where were you already working on your own, maybe not a collection, but kind of own designs, t-shirts, whatever, before the DSNY project?
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, I first started making t-shirts. I started screen printing t-shirts back in, like, 2001. You know, that's when I first started the Heron Preston label. Mm. You know, I'm like a streetwear kid. I worked retail in San Francisco. I worked at a sneaker store called True. I worked at another store called Red Five, which was like San Francisco's version of Colette. Mm. It was probably as big as the space here. It was very small, and you know, we sold everything from t-shirts to books to incense to, you know, CDs, mixtapes. I think we sold Holotronics, like Diplo's, one of Diplo's mixtapes. You know, when you when that sound of mashups was becoming a thing, you know. So I worked in that store, and so it was heavily influenced by just like culture. And so I started a T-shirt line called Heron Preston, and you know, the logo was in cursive, and it was on these really nice like satin woven labels. And I was inspired by another line called Clarendon, which had like I think it was the Gucci or Chanel logo. And that was their logo. And so, you know, it was kind of introducing this kind of luxury vibe into streetwear, which is what Clarendon was doing. Mm-hmm. So I was inspired by that. I was like, I want to introduce like a very premium, high level, like streetwear line.
And you said this was early 2000s?
Yeah, this was like 2000, 2001. so that's why my name was in cursive, and it was Heron. Preston is my middle name. Mm-hmm. Johnson is my last name. Huh. And I wanted it to sound like fancy.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted it to sound super fancy. So I named it Heron Preston. And so that was the very first time I had ever made like T-shirts. I was screen printing them by hand myself out in Hunters Point at this this like factory that made all of like San Francisco skate industry T-shirts. So you see a lot of like Thrasher tees being made, and all kinds of different brands being made there. And so they had like a 4-color manual press in the corner that was like collecting dust because they had just updated to like proper machines. So like, yeah, you can go in the corner and do whatever you want. Literally do whatever you want. Like they didn't even charge me to like use their paint or anything. I was just paying for screens to get made and paying for like American Apparel blanks. So the printing was all free, which was awesome. So I was just printing these T-shirts by myself. And I was selling them because I was working in retail. My boss
let you sell them there.
He let me sell them there.
That's awesome.
And he also had his own line, and he was selling them through like Beams Japan.
Oh, shit.
And so I was selling them out in Japan and like in Fred Segal in LA and San Francisco. And you know, I had these little accounts here and there selling hand pressing T-shirts. But then when I moved to New York for college, I kind of gave it up because I lost touch of it all. I wasn't making them myself anymore. Like, how am I going to do that all the way in New York? So I started blogging instead and taking photos and making videos. And that's eventually how I met Virgil and all of my awesome friends today. But yeah, so I was doing T-shirts before the collection. Moved to New York, started blogging. Then I started to miss making tees. Huh. So I started making tees again, and kind of like my reintroduction into making T-shirts was this Givenchy bootleg T-shirt. This was maybe like, I don't know, 7-8 years ago when Riccardo Tisci had done that black Rottweiler T-shirt, which was the biggest fucking T-shirt in fashion. So popular, I was like, I want to bootleg that, but I'm only going to make it in white. I'm only going to make it in a white tee, which does not exist. Like, the real one only came in black,
right.
And I purposely wanted it to make it look fake. And that was kind of the statement I was trying to make.
Did you copy the graphic of it exactly, just change the color of the tee?
Yeah, exactly. So I found someone who had the real tee. I, like, took a photo of it on, like, a Canon 5D, and then Photoshopped it out, just took the graphic off, and I just printed it on a white T-shirt instead downstairs in this Nike space. So I was working at Nike at the time. We had this space on Bowery and Houston called Stadiums. Mm-hmm. And Stadiums was this, like, multi convertible. It had retail in front, and then it had a screening space. In the middle, we were screening World Cup games or NBA games, and in the back there was a customization space where you could customize varsity jackets and have meetings with design consultants and pick out graphics and patches and stuff. And downstairs in the basement is where it was all made. So we had embroidery machines, we had direct to garment machines, we had vinyl cutters, we had all these machines to make stuff. So during downtime, right?
just
make your own shit. And so that's what we were all doing. Like, not only me, but a bunch of my friends, like Mike Sherman, who does Chinatown Market now.
Oh,
like,
was he there too?
He was there. He made the Givenchy T-shirt for me because he knew how to use the machines. And so me and Mike, I was like, Mike, can you make this tee for me real quick?
He's like, this looks kind of familiar.
Yeah, so we had to print it on the tee. So the very original tee was printed half and half. So you can see like the Rottweiler mouth being cut in half, and we had to print the second half. So that was the first tee that we made. And then I went to kind of mass produce them, but not like super mass. It was like I made like 60 of them.
Okay.
Like, I printed up 60 at a screen printing shop here in New York and started selling those like online. and I was like taking a Sharpie and writing everyone's name on it and personalizing it. And that was kind of like my reintroduction to like t-shirts. Was that Givenchy bootleg. I photographed Theophilus London in it. That he was like my campaign, the face of my campaign. Put those online, and you know, I sent it to a lot of like Tumblr kids. Like this is before Instagram, right? So it's like Tumblr was like the place. So it blew up on Tumblr. And then after that, I did like a NASCAR t-shirt.
Okay.
And you know, that was all about playing with logos that I didn't have the rights to. So there was like Coca-Cola and Budweiser and Home Depot and Caterpillar and M&M's.
The full like super patchy.
Yeah.
Kind of like,
yeah. Like just like a NASCAR uniform, like a NASCAR jacket. And so, you know, I had all these logos on the shirt I didn't have the rights to. And I made up a story that I just found that shirt. I didn't make it. So it was called A Found Factory Defect. And the story was that I was in Tennessee, which I had never been to Tennessee before. I just assumed that there was a NASCAR fan base there. I was like, yeah, I was in Tennessee, and I stumbled on this box in a thrift store. It was a dusty box. I opened it up, and I found all these factory defect. I called it factory defect because the NASCAR logo was flipped upside down.
Okay.
So it was a mistake that no one wanted, and it was in this box. So I found them, and I just relabeled the shirts with Heron Preston labels, and I sold them. And so people believe that story. And I just, you know, again, I told that story to get away with kind of any lawsuits or anything, cease and desist or whatever. So it never happened. I never got a cease and desist for any of, like, there's, like, 20 logos.
What about the Givenchy one?
That never, no one, no one came after me after that as either. You know, funny with that one, I actually wanted Ricardo to actually sell those in a Givenchy store. That was my goal. I was like, I don't know how he's going to feel about this. Is he going to be a hater or not? Yeah. So I actually didn't even take that leap in approaching him or finding out a way I could sell. I thought it was going to be such a cool concept for a brand to verify or authenticate a bootleg and sell that. Yeah. For me, it was like an artist interpretation of, you know, their real shirt. Funny enough, my friend Ava works with Marc Jacobs, and she does bootlegs with Marc Jacobs.
She does?
Yeah, and she sells her bootlegs. And so it actually happened, you know, not with me, but it actually happened. So I was really happy to see that happen with her project.
That's rad. So it's like bootlegs of Marc Jacobs from someone within Marc Jacobs?
Yeah. That's incredible. Yeah, from Marc Jacobs' friend. So yeah, I was doing this NASCAR bootleg, and, you know, that totally took off. You know, the New York Times actually ended up writing an article.
Oh, wow. What year was this, roughly?
This one may have been like 2011 or 12 or something.
And you were still 13. At Nike kind of full time?
I was at Nike like full time. So that t-shirt took off. New York Times wrote an article about the resurgence of logo culture.
Oh, wow.
And they kicked off the article about my t-shirts. And I think Shane Hood by Air was referenced in that article as well. And, you know, that was a fun project. And then after that, I did a sneaker. I remixed an Air Force One. Huh. So I basically took off the swoosh. I worked with a shoe cobbler to take off the swoosh and then stitch onto the shoe a bathing ape, Bapes the Star, cut out of Gucci fabric. So those were called Street Sweeper Air Force Ones. I only made like 12 of those. And that was kind of like my third bootleg, you know. And so now you can see I'm doing these drops. And then I launched, then I did a turtleneck, you know, and that came from a show studio project. That was another just like t-shirt drop. Then I launched a website called HPC Trading Co., inspired by all these like Trading Co. storefronts in Chinatown, like ABC Trading. Like they're like a print shop, XYZ, you know, trading. So I was living in Chinatown, actually here on East Broadway. So I launched HPC Trading Co., which was like my art objects destination, inspired by Tom Sachs.
And you actually had a storefront for that, or was it a website?
No, it was a website. Okay. It was a website. So I looked at Tom Sachs and the work that he was doing, and he has an online store where he was selling like playing cards and little objects and some of his art and like Sharpie pens and t-shirts. And I was like, I want to have a shop like that where it's not just like soft goods. It's not just a t-shirt anymore. Heron Preston has a bigger vision beyond just t-shirts and like you know, I'm also inspired. I also want to make art. And so that was, you know, I made a table, you know, I had a table for sale on there, and I had these little NYPD bricks inspired by the barricades, those concrete barricades you see around New York that they put up for like parades and stuff. I made miniature versions of that. You know, I poured concrete in my backyard and, you know, spray painted those white and made an NYPD stencil. And, you know, I was selling little bricks for like $100. And I made medical marijuana leaf pens, and I was selling pens for like $20. And so I was having fun with all these different ideas. And then after that, I launched the DSNY project.
Okay.
So that's kind of like me getting back into making t-shirts after San Francisco, and then making more stuff, and then going into DSNY.
So there were like two points I guess I was curious about is, one is you said when you came to New York, you came for college.
Yeah, Parsons.
And you basically took a little break, I guess, a break from the kind of t-shirt making and kind of began that. How long was that between getting here and then making that first Givenchy piece?
I would say, I would probably say like 3 years or something. I took a 3 or 4 year pause.
What'd you study at Parsons?
Design and management.
Oh, okay.
design and management. I graduated with a business degree, funny enough, from an art school. I didn't want to do fashion design.
I did not know that existed.
Yeah, it didn't really exist at the time. It was brand new when I was looking to colleges to go to. I thought I wanted to do fashion design, so I was looking to the curriculums, and I was like, actually, I don't want to learn how to make patterns, and I don't want to learn how to sew. I don't want to learn how to do any. I want to just make shit, you know, like, I don't want to spend the time, have to go through this whole curriculum to like just do fashion. I was like, for some reason, I wasn't into it. I was more into like marketing and ideas and, you know, innovation. And so Parsons had this program called Design and Management. So I got accepted and came out here.
Do you know what? Do you remember when you were at school? Were all your studies kind of pointed to you eventually starting something on your own? Like, did you already have that in mind?
Kind of. It was a little trickier, I think, for kids in my curriculum. Because we weren't doing like a traditional course like photography or fashion design or graphic design. We were doing like half like design process and like marketing and creative industries. I had to take like math class at an art school. I was so frustrated about that. I was like, what the fuck? You know, but it was really interesting kind of some of the courses. I had like an anthropologist, and all the teachers were actually working professionals as well. Right. So they would bring a lot of like their professional career into the curriculum. So, you know, one of my first jobs was this whole like ethnography, like on Shoppers. And so I would go and like to Macy's, this agency actually hired me to go and study people's shopping behaviors. And I would go to like Macy's, like Herald Square, and watch like women buy perfume. And it was for this cosmetics company. And they're like, yeah, we want to know like what people are asking.
Was this out of Parsons?
Yeah, out of Parsons. It was like my first job while I was still at Parsons. So it was really interesting stuff like that. You know, I had like design mapping and fucking like innovation classes, and it was really interesting stuff. So I did that, and then I ended up working at like this creative consultancy called Naked Communications.
Okay.
They were based out of London, but they had an office in New York on Green Street in Soho, across the street from the Babe store. I remember having a party, and Cuddy came because he used to work at that store.
At the Babe store?
At the Babe store. Really? Yeah, Kid Cuddy used to work at the Babe store. I think he worked with, was Vashti working there maybe at the time? So, yeah, I have like photos of like our office, like holiday party, and like, and the Fat Jew came. The Fat Jew was in a rap group, and I think his rap group performed at my holiday party, and like Kid Cuddy came. It was so, like, these were like very special times.
Was Cuddy already Cuddy at that point, or was he just the guy that worked at the Babe store?
He was, I think, just the guy that worked at the Babe store. Just a homie.
That's so sick.
So I worked at Naked, you know. It was like, what do you do after studying that, like after out of Parsons, you know, like where do you go? So a lot of kids went into like starting their own companies. Mm-hmm. A lot of kids went into working for agencies, like marketing agencies, advertising agencies. I did this agency job for a bit, and after that, you know, the Great Recession actually hit in the States, where everyone was getting fired. And I was one of those guys that got fired from my agency. I remember they pulled like 20 people into a room and they basically like cut us off, and like I had to leave. I had to
like
go pack.
That day.
Yeah, that day. Shit. I had to go pack up my stuff and in a box like the movies.
You see that walk out with
that walk out
bobblehead.
Like the movies, like box shit up. And literally, I was like, had butterflies. I was almost like sweating bricks. I was like, how am I going to pay rent? What am I going to fucking do? I wasn't expecting to just get fired today. Yeah. What the fuck? So I called up my boy at Nike. And I was like, yo, I just got fired. He's like, bro, we just fired like 50,000 people as well. Like, no one's hiring right now. So for like 3 or 4 months, or maybe even, yeah, maybe was it 3, 4, 5 months, I was like just no job, collecting like unemployment, like blogging from my fucking apartment on Canal Street. Then I started interviewing with Nike.
Okay.
Got a job at Nike, got hired to be the marketing specialist in New York for Nike Sportswear. So
did the blogging you started up or were doing when you didn't have a job help to get that Nike job?
Oh, for sure. For sure. It did. Blogging helped me get a book deal.
Really?
Which Nike, before I worked for Nike, actually, when I was at Naked, Nike actually sponsored the launch of my book launch.
I did not know you had a book.
Yeah, it was called The Young and the Banging. And so Al Moran, who now does like Moran Gallery in LA, he had book publishing. And he was like, he was this guy in Florida and Miami who had a printing company printing like party flyers for all the Miami clubs. But he was also passionate about art. So he was like, I want to make art books. So I think he made a book with like Dan Colin. He did a couple art books, and he approached me based off of my blog because he saw that I was documenting in New York in a really fresh way. I was covering a lot of events that I would go to at like A-Life.
Yeah.
You know, I was friends with Aaron. You know, I did interviews with him. You know, I was just documenting downtown New York culture, youth culture. Like, I wanted to open up a window and show my friends back home in San Francisco just what it was like to live in New York. And through that blog, I just started getting a lot of followers and people following, you know, my photography and my videos. And I would write a lot. You know, I was writing like a proper journalist. Like, these entries were like proper, like, paragraphs long. So Al noticed all of this. And he was like, dude, this could be a book. Do you want a book? To publish a book with me. I was like, hell yeah. So it was a Polaroid book. It was like a yearbook. I just saw in downtown New York as a high school. The yellow taxi cabs were the school buses. The restaurants were our cafeterias. The streets were our hallways. And, you know, the more established and successful people around me were like my teachers. And the parties, the clubs were like the house parties and people hooking up. You know, that was just all very reminiscent. It was just like high school all over again. So I was like, downtown New York needs a yearbook for everyone who lives here. So I did this yearbook, and then Nike sponsored the launch at their Nike ID space on Elizabeth Street. So that space had just closed down, and they just had a white box gallery. So they're like, hey, we got this space down in Nolita. Do you want to have your book launched there? And I was like, sure. So they put up all the budget to have the Young and the Banging book launched there. And that was my first time kind of getting in bed with Nike before I even worked for them. So when I went to interview, they're like, what's the most creative thing you've ever done in your life? And I was like, well, I did this yearbook that you guys... remember this yearbook you guys did with me? And so I think that really helped get me a job at Nike.
Well, it's amazing is like, because from everywhere from, and you're doing, I guess you're doing something with NASA right now.
Yeah.
And like from there, from the Department of Sanitation, from this Nike book thing, from all these things, all these kind of amazing projects open up, but they started, I guess, because you just decided to like initiate something out of self-interest.
For sure.
And then they started catching fire and like getting interest. And even from like the I guess the t-shirts you were making when you were at Red 5, is that right?
Yeah, San Francisco? Red 5, yeah.
Had you all, like even before that, are you from San Francisco?
Yeah, born and raised.
Even before that kind of Red 5 stuff, were you always making stuff on your own, just like putting stuff out there? Or was that the first time? Like, well, do you remember the first time you actually made something on your own, like for consumption by someone else?
It was the t-shirts. It was the Heron Preston brand. But I think, you know, just making stuff with my hands. You know, I had really cool education from elementary school. Art classes. I was a part of the Boys and Girls Club. You know, they had like a clay workshop. You know, making, you know, I was making bowls and just playing with clay. You know, and painting ceramics and you know, making all kinds of stuff in school. And so I think just, you know, having all this hands-on experience, I think just, you know, I found something I really loved, and I just loved making stuff. So yeah, when I got old enough to start making t-shirts, I think that was the first kind
of, just seemed kind of natural, I guess.
Yeah, commercial thing that I that I dabbled in.
Did you have any, was there anybody like in San Francisco in your family or kind of like close circle of family friends that had a career in some sort of creative thing that you're like, oh, I can actually
yeah,
do that?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, my dad had his own sportswear company.
Oh, really?
Called,
oh,
his name is Bart. So he had a company called Bartolo Athletic.
No way. Does it still exist?
Yeah, no, it doesn't, but he wants to kind of bring it back. He loves golf, so he wants to start like doing a whole golf golf line. So he was doing Bartolo Athletic and literally selling that shit out of the trunk of
that's
his Bronco.
Incredible. That's so right.
So he was making like hockey jerseys, and he was making like baseball jerseys and shorts and
hoodies. Does he still have those pieces somewhere?
You know, I asked him. I don't think he has many next to, like, he doesn't have really much of anything left over, because I wanted to find that stuff and like Instagram about it and tell people about it and storytell around it and just have it as archives. Because that was a big part, I think, of what inspired me to get into making clothes and designing apparel as well, was, you know, my dad got into it. He's an artist, like he can like draw, and like he was doing all the family reunion graphics for all t-shirts, you know, he was drawing all this stuff. So he always had like pencils and pads and everything around in the house, and my grandfather as well. He's a preacher, and so he was always doing these big like canvases, like Bible verses. He would illustrate and paint these Bible verses and stuff. So those are like the two artists, my grandfather and my dad and my family. So, yeah, when I got into, you know, making T-shirts, it was kind of like maybe a natural kind of thing that happened.
Do you know, like, again, from the sanitation thing, from the NASCAR pieces, from the NASA stuff now, and there obviously seems to be that theme of you working either with another brand organization or a set of brands, whether they know it or not, even the Givenchy thing, and reappropriating in some way, or finding some way to kind of, like, I guess it's like that you're not, it's not about creating a kind of like isolated beauty or design, but there's always some attachment to some other seemingly disparate culture or brand.
Right.
Is that intentional, or is just kind of like you just interested in other things going on and you want to bring them into the work you're doing?
Yeah, I think I'm just interested in kind of bridging the gap between like what's happening in the real world. And kind of enhancing that or remixing it or twisting it and kind of through my version. That just feels real and authentic. You know, these are just real things that are just happening, and I want to, you know, figure out ways to be a part of it through, you know, what I'm making. So I think there's kind of like these cultural kind of signifiers or these touch points, you know, connecting people to this work that we all have a shared experience with the Givenchy tee. Like we all kind of get that, and NASCAR, like NASCAR jackets were being worn in the hood like by dudes because it matched their Jordans. And so we have kind of like those visuals, and we have kind of like that peek into that culture and into fashion. And so, you know, there's always kind of like me pointing at things that are happening in the real world and kind of storytelling around,
trying to highlight it somehow.
Highlight that, yeah.
So maybe like last question, just kind of like wrap up, because it seems like obviously you have a knack of, I think, like identifying interesting things for yourself and then realizing or finding audiences for that. Like you just had this string of sort of like growing and growing successes.
Right.
So congrats on all that.
Thank you.
Was there a moment where it didn't work, where you're like, oh, this is gonna be so good, and then like nobody cared, or it didn't really like take off, or you had to like completely adjust?
Yeah, for sure. I think I've kind of experienced some of that with my new collection now, because I'm not just selling to like a specific small group of people who I know will get it. You know, I'm being sold now around the world, from everywhere from like Asia to fucking, you know, Middle East, you know, Australia, Europe. You know, I'm being sold, and so now also like the people who are shopping for my clothes, the demographics have changed.
And I guess you also don't have a personal connection to that culture as much, because there's so much more different types of people out there.
So many more different types of people who are shopping in the stores that I'm sold in. So it's like, oh yeah, they'll like that, and like people won't even get it. It'll be totally over their fucking heads. So I'm starting to now, trying to like learn as much about like what people want, what people like. You know, I never had to, because I felt it. It just came. Yeah. It just came naturally to me. I knew exactly who I was selling to. I knew exactly what they want. But now it's like learning more about, like, you know, I'm opening my first store in Hong Kong, like, at the end of this month. Nice. So it's like understanding the Chinese consumer, like the fits they like, the graphics they like, the stories that they like. Huh. What are they into? So it's like training myself and just, you know, trying to soak up as much information as possible for this whole new landscape of fashion that, you know, I was never really a part of.
That just means you need to, like, travel more, even.
Yeah, seriously, yeah. I'm not even trying to travel. You know, it's crazy. I'm at the point now where I'm like, I just want to be at home. You know, I just want to be chilling at home, like, with my dogs and, like, you know, relaxing. You know, I'm like, fuck. It's changed a bit, you know. I'm not, like, you know, I'm 35 now, and, you know, it's funny. I saw on Worldstar, I think this on Instagram, it was like, you know you're old when all you want to do is just stay home and smoke a blunt.
That sounds so good.
That sounds so good. You know, I DJ a bunch, so when I'm DJ, I party a lot, you know? So when I'm at home, I just want to be home. I just want to chill because I'm on the road so much.
Dude, well, thank you for coming out. Yeah. I'll give you a little more time to go hang at home before you take off again.
Thank you.
It was fun. Thanks.
Thanks. That was awesome. Thanks so much.
Yeah, and I'll let you know when these are good.
I think I know who makes this. Chen and Kai.
Yeah, Chen and Kai.
I'm trying to work with them, actually, on
the
Carhartt.
They're sick.
Carhartt. Yeah,
Have you gotten in touch with them?
I did. I went to their studio. I met them. I actually bought one of their, like, three of their coasters that they made.
Yeah, they're rad. They do some rad stuff.
So, yeah, they're really
cool. They were here last week, and they brought this as a kind of, like, centerpiece.
Oh, cool.
And I was like, what is it? And they're like, I was like, what do you do with it? And he's like, you just fucking look at it.
Yeah.
I was like, so we just look at it.
Yeah. I love their work.
Sick. All right, thanks, Aaron.
Sick. Thank you so much.